Okay, well, everybody, welcome to the last session of the day. As you think about your experience thus far at the Ministry Lift Small Group Ministry Conference, what are some words that come to mind? Awesome, okay, I'll accept that. Okay, challenging. Formative, good. Okay. Sorry, I missed that one. Rewarding, good. Glad to hear that. How about you onliners, if there's any of you that are with us, how's your experience been so far? What are some words that come to mind for you? As we're waiting for the onliners to respond, the lag time. Another question that I have for you relates to house church. Have any of you ever been to a house church? Any of you ever been to a house church? Okay, so we've got a house church, so a church that meets in a home. Or maybe meets under a tree, like in Africa or something like that. Okay, so a number of you have. It's sometimes hard to define what do we mean by a house church, right? When does a small group stop being a small group and become like a church? And so I recognize that there's some terminological issues that we probably need to work with at some point. Thank you for handing out the handouts. Yes, they're back on the chair there. Okay. For those of you that have been a part of a house church, is there one or two of you just want to share a little bit about your experience in a house church? Whether it was a one-time visit or something longer, what was your experience? Sorry? We always think of the church as a building. It's true, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, I grew up with that very strong idea that the church was the building. And I still catch myself all the time saying on Sunday morning, I'm heading to church, right? As if that's it. That's the destination, the church building. And church is so much more than that, isn't it? We are the church. Absolutely. Yeah, Dan. Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay, so a church that actually says Central Heights meets here, right? Yeah, I know. I sometimes do announcements at our church on Sunday too, and I often am tempted to say welcome to South Langley Church, right? And I'm starting to rephrase that and say welcome South Langley Church or something like that to reflect my larger theological understanding of the church, bigger than a building. All right, well, we're going to be talking about the global house church movement. It's something that I've researched and I've been involved with. Let me share a little bit about my story so that you kind of understand where I'm coming from. I was a pastor for 16 years in a local evangelical free church, Langley Evangelical Free Church, in fact, serving in a variety of pastoral roles while I was there. And towards the end of my time at the church, I made some fatal mistakes. One of the fatal mistakes was I preached through the book of Acts. Another fatal mistake that I made was I began to study the church in depth. What is the church? What does it look like? And I began to ask the question, how can we be the church in our culture today and to do that effectively? And it led me down some rather interesting paths. As I began to give myself permission to rethink the church, I became open to other possibilities. And one of them was the whole idea of house church. And I guess what really attracted me to house church was this whole notion that we could potentially take church to the people, that we could be the church wherever people are, that we could gather in places where people are more comfortable, like in homes or at the golf course or wherever. And so, I mean, these were some of the questions that began to haunt me. It was about this time we were involved in an Alpha course at our church at Langley Evangelical Free. My wife and I were table leaders. And so it was partway through the Alpha course. I think we were on the session on the church. One of the gals in our session, in our group, and she had come weekly, was very antagonistic about the church. And I couldn't actually figure out why she kept coming, to hear about Christianity. And she was like, had very strong opinions and didn't really like anything much of what we were talking about. But she continued to come. And as we were talking about the church, she piped up. And she looked at each one of us around the table, and she said, "If church was like this, I might consider it." And I thought, why not? I mean, that was a defining moment for me. It set me on all sorts of thoughts. It got me thinking about, why couldn't church be like this? Why couldn't we meet in small groups? Why couldn't a small group become a church and function as a church? And so the long and the short of it was, after much prayer, study, preaching through Acts and all these things, we felt called into starting house churches in the Lower Mainland. And so Langley E. Free commissioned us to do it. The Evangelical Free Church of Canada blessed us in that as well. And so we had the full support of our church and denomination to do that. And so initially we had a group from LEFC, Langley E. Free, that came with us. We're a part of the start of the journey. That's what we called our house church network, the journey. And one of the exciting things for me was that Lori, my wife, and I, we had been building relationships with people in our townhouse complex where we lived, and we saw this as a golden opportunity to really be Jesus in that community. And I don't know, some of you were probably in the talk by Dennis Wilkinson earlier today on the missional communities. We had that opportunity to experience that. And we started a little house church in our townhouse complex. We just, had built these relationships. We saw some people that were spiritually interested, and we invited them to come, and we started doing stuff like watching Alpha and going through Christianity Explored video series and a number of different things. And God began to work in the lives of our neighbors. I still vividly remember that night as we were gathered in our little house church. And Kathy, one of our neighbors, who had been coming pretty much from since day one, prayed to receive Jesus in our living room. And what struck me was I was thrilled to see that happen. But I was also thrilled to see my 8-year-old son sitting on the couch beside her and seeing somebody come to know Jesus in our living room. And I thought, wow, isn't this awesome that we could be a part of that? We had another neighbor who, a Jewish gal, who she liked all of the Old Testament stuff that we would do. And so we did this one particular series, Stranger on the Road to Emmaus, which is a walk through the Bible, and we lost her as soon as we finished the Old Testament. But we found out several months later that God had spoken to her. And she too had asked Jesus to come into her life, and so that was exciting for us to see God work in the lives of our neighbors. We had an opportunity as well to go to Thailand. We wanted to take our family on a cross-cultural experience. It worked out in our lives to do that for 8.5 months 4 years ago. And one of the main reasons we wanted to go was to see what God was doing in Thailand through small churches, house churches often. And it was quite amazing for me to see firsthand how God was working in a country. And you hear this over and over in countries like China, in Ethiopia. I'll share some of the stories. But how, because of the model, is so simple, you can reproduce it so quickly, and a movement can start. And you see this in Thailand and in many other parts of the world, and we'll look at that in just a moment. So I've had that experience here in Canada, being a part of house churches. In Thailand, we saw something of what God is doing there. And I just want to share some of the stuff that I've picked up over the years, and how we can learn from the house church movement. I'm not here to convince or try to convince anyone to go into the house churches. We're not in a house church right now. We're in a conventional kind of church, but my heart is still beats with that kind of missional community stuff, and I find that very, very exciting. So let's talk a little bit about house churches around the world, and this is a bit of a sketch of what God is doing globally through this particular expression of church. It's estimated that worldwide there are approximately 450 million Christians within conventional churches, 10 million in cell-based churches, and about 450 million in simple organic structures such as house churches, marketplace churches, or meeting under the baobab tree outside in the backyard, okay? And so, you know what that does for me? It makes me realize that being a Canadian, I have a narrow perspective on the church and what it looks like in the world. You know, I see it as this way, the church on the corner, and yet for many people, many Christians in the world, that's not their reality. They see it very differently. You know, I've heard stories out of China. I mean, it's just amazing what God is doing in China, and I'll just share a bit about that. China went from having approximately 5 million believers pre-communism, pre-Chairman Mao, to 80 to 130 million believers today. Now, for many years, for decades, we had no idea what was happening in China. The assumption was that the church was being utterly destroyed. And then out of the ashes, they realize, actually under the ashes, that the church was thriving and growing and multiplying through house churches all over the country. And what intrigues me today is that the leaders of these house church networks have said publicly that even if peace came, and it kind of is coming to some of these regions in China, but they've said, we want to stay in our house churches. Even if persecution and the threat of persecution went away, we want to continue to be a part of these house church networks. And that's intriguing to me, that they have that perspective. I had the opportunity to go to China to teach. Trinity has a Master of Arts in Leadership program, which we do in China. The first cohort was in English. Now we do it in Mandarin. And we're increasingly getting unsaved students coming particularly from the business realm in China. Almost all of them pray to receive Christ before the end of their program of studies. And it's not because we as profs are telling them the gospel, it's because they see something different. And they're coming to us and they're saying, what's going on? I want to know more about why you have these values. And there's an eagerness and an openness to engage in that. One of my colleagues who runs the China program, he said that on one of his visits, he was meeting with an executive for Motorola in one of their large office buildings in China. And the executive Christian guy was sharing with him how there's 70 churches meeting in that office building. I mean, it just kind of blows me away, you know? What God is doing in places like China. India is another place where house churches have taken off in a significant kind of way. They saw a movement, over 100,000 started in India, they estimate from 2001 to 2006. Victor Chaudhry has said these little house churches in India are like starfish. The more you divide them, the more they replicate. And that is often the case in these countries. Ethiopia is an interesting case. I mean, some of you that have been around a while remember the persecution that took place In Ethiopia in the 1980s, the church was forced to go underground in 1982. The Meseri Christos Church was a large church, 14 congregations with 5,000 members, and it was squished. I mean, the government said, no more meetings, you're done. They were forced to go underground. And so 10 years later, the church is allowed to resurface. What happened? It had grown 10 times, tenfold, while going underground. And again, there's something about persecution, right, that can make and purify the church, but it emerged with some 50,000 people who were a part of this underground network of churches. You can watch the story Against Great Odds in video format. In an Asian Muslim country, more than 150,000 Muslims embrace Jesus and gather in more than 3,000 locally led Isa Jamaats, or Jesus groups. Any idea which country this is? Where it's reportedly the country now where there are more people becoming Christians than any other country in the world. Any idea? Saudi Arabia? No. Indonesia? Nope. That's a lot of people coming to know Christ in these places, but not those. It's actually Iran. Who would have thought, eh? Just amazing. God is doing an incredible... You don't hear that in the news about Iran, do you? But there's some amazing things. And one of the books that's at the end of your slides, I recommend... Oh, did I bring it? Yeah, I did. This book, Church Planting Movements, does chronicle something of what God is doing in that part of the world. What about in a little bit closer to home in the United States? How is God using house churches? Well, it's estimated that there are 5 million plus people involved in house churches in the States. It's so hard to get a read on this because they don't register necessarily, and you can't count them. But that's the estimate. Neil Cole, some of you may have read some of his material, such as Organic Church or Organic Leadership. He's written a number of things. Started something called Church Multiplication Associates, but it didn't start as that. It started as him going to the coffee shop and going there regularly. It became like a third space for him, kind of like an extension of his living room. Got to know people, started to have conversations with people, and all of a sudden they're asking spiritually, well, you know, they want to know more about God and Jesus, and you know, and he's having these discussions, and he recognized after a while that they were actually functioning like a church. You know, some had become Christians, and they were discipling and praying together, and all of these things. And so they've seen this multiply many times over in the last number of years. In 2000, they had 10 of these organic kinds of churches. Then they saw the next year 52 start, in the next year 106. By 2007, they had well over 1,000 of these organic churches in many states and nations. And so you can go to their website and read about what they're doing. Now, I mean, not all of these churches are healthy, productive. You know, I'm not delusional, right? You know, a lot of things can go sideways too, and that's that's one of the questions that I hear about house churches. Well, how do you keep them on track doctrinally? You know, don't they become deviant and all of that? And some do, right? And that's why I think it's so important to have accountability structures and ways of staying on track. I just want to show you this NBS report on house churches in the States. It'll give you a little bit of a sense of what's happening in the South. So this is going to work, Caleb, through there? Okay. Thank you.
At a time when religion can often turn into part of a political battleground, and the very weak one of this country's original megachurches, the Crystal Cathedral in California, filed for bankruptcy protection, there are some Americans who are looking at worship in a whole different way and in a whole different place, and perhaps there's one right here. Here is NBC's Chris Jansen.
Good morning.
I'm well.
Good. Well.
For 25 years, Pastor Mike Trzezinski has welcomed his parishioners before Sunday services.
Elizabeth?
How are you?
I'm good. How are you, hon?
But for the past 3 years, not at a church.
Majesty.
Instead, this small group worships at home, a different house each week. It's only about a dozen people, but they represent a major shift in the way many American Christians are celebrating their faith.
The church is us. It's the people.
They're called simply and accurately house churches. An estimated 6 to 12 million Americans attend them. And a recent Pew Research survey found that 9% of American Protestants attend only home services.
Amen.
In an era where we have mega churches and we have large shopping malls and we have bigger and bigger institutions, many people feel lost.
I praise God for all of you.
But these small groups foster familiarity. Instead of a traditional sermon from Pastor Trzezinski, everyone can speak, sharing their concerns and praying for one another's needs.
Just hearing what other people are going through and experiences they've had, it's priceless.
Even the biggest supporters of house churches admit they're not for everyone. Some people like the inspiration they get from the physical building, the stained glass windows, the choir or the organ. And others, frankly, just like the anonymity of a bigger church. Those beautiful churches, though, are expensive, and the economy has many Christians reassessing their priorities.
I did have one lady say to me one time, I'm tired of paying somebody else's light bill.
Here, a percentage of the weekly collection pays Pastor Trzezinski's salary. The rest allows them to do charitable works near home and abroad. For the pastor and millions of Christians, a simpler way to live their faith. Chris Jansing, NBC News, West Springfield, Massachusetts.
Well, it gives you an idea of how things are developing in the States. A book that may be of interest to you is a book by Barna. I do have a copy here called Revolution that talks about some of the trends that he sees in the United States based on his research. In 2000, if you looked at the demographics of church in the state, 70% of people were attending a conventional church, 5% in these alternative faith-based communities such as house churches, cyber churches, marketplace churches, 5% were simply experiencing church as family, and 20% through media, arts, and culture. So that could be watching your favorite preacher on TV or whatever the case may be. In 2005, as he looked at the trends, he projected that that's going to change significantly by 2025, where you see a marked decrease in people who call conventional church their church home, a significant increase in the numbers here related to alternative faith-based, and also increase in media arts culture commitments. That's significant, even if and the trend seems to be moving in that direction, maybe not quite as dramatically as he, Barna, envisioned, but it seems to be moving in that direction. People are more open to different kinds of church experiences and are willing to explore, to be a part of something that they deem as vibrant and meaningful to them. But also, I mean, you've got this whole missional movement which is driving some of this, right? You know, we heard from Dennis in the morning, some of you, and if you didn't catch his session, make sure you watch the recording in a week when it's uploaded, because it was great, where he talks about his meta community, what he's doing, being on mission, living where the people need to hear about Jesus, engaging in mission through the daily rhythms of life. And so I think that's an important statistic. Canada, I mean, this is just a smattering of house church networks. This is an Alliance one in Chilliwack. Calgary one, this is part of Center Street, one of those big churches where they've recognized that house church has a place, and they've created a ministry called East Edge, kind of like another campus, but it's many campuses, house churches, You can view it that way. Winnipeg, there's the Journey, which I was a part of. Ontario, the Meeting Place, another one of these big churches, but they purposefully decided, well, we're going to make house church the central part of who we are. We'll still get together in corporate celebration, worship, but house church is going to be the centerpiece. And this one here, Pathfinders, the former executive director of Navigators Canada, Ross Raines, gives leadership to this, and it spans across Canada. So that gives you an idea. Yeah, Dan.
Randy, go back to your last slide. I just wondered if Marna, does he address the fact that, you know, in my context, you know, X number of years ago, in the time I was in ministry, that you could guarantee that people would be in church most Sundays. And now, as we statistically review it, it's 2 out of 4. And so I think that we're fairly, you know, standard as far as that's concerned. So does he address that, or is that just his projection? Because people are not attending church. They still claim their conventional church connection. They just don't attend. Does he address that in his move to 30% to 35% by 2025, or is it some other category?
Right. Yeah, I don't recall him addressing that in his study.
Just wondering.
Yeah. I mean, these numbers reflect a percentage of Protestant population who actually would say that conventional church is our primary place. Yeah. So the comment was that these stats are actually discouraging, particularly, if I heard you correctly, the media, arts, and culture increase. Yeah. And I would agree with this part here. You know, if your primary church experience is sitting in front of the television or the computer, you know, and receiving one-way communication from somebody, that's not church. I mean, that's watching a program, right? Church is community. Church is being in community, vibrant community, vital community with others, pursuing the interests of God. And so I'm with you on that. I'm not concerned about this part here as much, provided that, you know, that these alternative faith-based communities are vital, vibrant, healthy communities. And they are churches, healthy communities. I'll stick with that. Loving Christ-centered communities on a mission to be and make growing disciples of Jesus. And that's important to me. I think, just to follow up on that comment too, I mean, what we're seeing here, I think, a few different things. I think part of it is a reaction to a perceived lack of vitality in some conventional churches. And people are going, well, you know, I don't want to be a part of that. Perhaps a perception of a lack of relevance in some of those. But I also think that what we're seeing is a desire for deeper community, which they may not be experiencing in their church, their conventional church. And they, you know, I'm not saying that automatically they'll experience it here. That's not the point I'm trying to make. But there is this longing for something. And I'm going to pick up on that theme in just a few minutes. What kind of longings do North American Christians have that would attract them to this kind of model? Okay, so there's the Canadian house churches. And I just wanted to make the comment that in the last 10 years, we're seeing more and more established churches saying, let's add this house church piece to our existing church. You see and hear about sometimes churches that will completely, established churches that will completely go into a house church model and say, okay, we're now, the leadership decided we're going to become house church based, and that's happening. But I think Calgary, what Center Street is doing and what the Meeting Place is doing is perhaps a better hybrid for North America, combining house church with established, vibrant established church. You know, and I'm not saying every church should do that, but I think that seems to be a long-term viable model. I think, too, that when house churches are part of strong networks, that, too, is viable. You know, where the house churches are getting together, there's encouragement, there's corporate celebration. You know, I think that togetherness is really important in staying on track. Yep, Dan. So what's the difference between a house church and a vibrant care group? I think that, you know, from our experience, what we noticed, and we had been in some very, very vibrant small groups in a conventional church situation. Good small groups, you know, and lots of good things happened. One of the things that we noticed when we moved into house church ministry is that I didn't have to go to board meetings anymore. Or nominations committee. I didn't have to, you know, you get my point here that there were a lot less obligations, and we actually had more time and energy to invest in people in the community, our church, but also people in the larger community. Now, I know that's not true of everybody. You know, that wouldn't necessarily translate, but we found that there was just, by and large, a greater ability to build into each other's lives and to build relationships with unsaved people.
Okay, but by definition, when you bring out Calgary and Ontario, the Meeting House, then when they are still maintaining their conventional model and they are fostering house churches, what is the difference between them fostering their life group or a care group or small group ministries and fostering house churches?
Yeah. Yeah, and I would see it as, I mean, it depends how they set them up. But yeah, you're right, there would still be some obligations where people would need to be involved in the larger organizational structures and the expectations that are a part of that. However, I think that with that, they're also choosing to simplify those structures, to go with a simple church approach. You know, this is the essence of who we are, house church, yeah, and we're going to meet together, and there's going to be, you know, some structures to keep that going, but we're not going to start over here and build 16 different programs necessarily. And so that's, I think, a difference, but I don't know their situation enough to say exactly where they fall on that spectrum.
I'm not trying to hijack your presentation. No.
I mean, for us, one of the things that we appreciated about House Church was that others in the group saw this as an opportunity to build relationships with our kids. You know, so, you know, Grandpa Marvin became like a grandpa to our kids. That was kind of nice because our grandparents are one and two provinces removed. And so, you know, to have that kind of connection was really valuable. And it's interesting to me that, you know, some of you maybe have read the study Hemorrhaging Faith on why Canadian youth are leaving or staying with the church. And one of the factors for Canadian youth staying with the church and staying with Christianity is having these multi-generational mentoring relationships. And so I like that possibility within house church. Not that it can't happen elsewhere, but we did see that happen. Now, in our case, we still had a close relationship with Langley E. Free, and so our kids did go to a midweek club program. I served in that club program too because I thought, well, you know, I didn't want to siphon off their resources. I wanted to be a part of serving as well. So, yeah, there was a partnership there. Tim.
Those hybrid models, do the house churches meet on Sundays in homes instead of at the church building?
I think it varies. Like, it just depends on how they have set up the hybrid. Like, I know of one hybrid where they basically said, you know, we bless these house churches. Don't feel like you have to come to the corporate gatherings. You know, and so, I mean, there was that sense. Now, I still think there's value in that collective. And so the meeting place, I know for sure they still have these collective gatherings, and they're structured and even scheduled, I think, in such a way that that can happen for people. Good questions. Thank you. Okay. I mentioned just a few minutes ago some of the longings that North American Christians have, and this article by Zahn, What Are Driving Today's Innovations in Leadership Journal, was helpful to me as I thought about this. She identifies four longings that many Christians have. One is for customization. If you read the book Missional Renaissance by Reggie McNeil, he really develops this theme. You know, and he challenges us as church leaders, as leaders in the you know, to actually change the scorecard. You know, what really matters in our ministries? And one of the things he says is we need to move from a programmatic approach to a people approach. As opposed to saying, you know, we've got 200 raw materials in our church and we're going to throw them into this process, this discipleship process, and wow, you know, if they take this class and go to this thing and do this, they're going to be mature disciples of Jesus. You know, something good might happen in the process. I don't want to be critical of that, but he's saying, and others are saying, that we need to step with people. Where are they at? How can we journey with them and customize this whole approach? That's why I love coaching so much, because it gives you an opportunity to customize, to come alongside, to help people take the next step wherever they're at and wherever they need to go. Participation is huge for a lot of North American Christians. They want to be involved in the process. And again, that was one of the things that we appreciated about our small group experiences and house church too, was the opportunity to interact, to participate, to discover truth together. You know, and I personally, I love Sunday morning formats where we have a chance to do that too, where we get to wrestle together in an interactive kind of way around Scripture. Incarnational community, the whole missional emphasis. People want to make a difference in their world, in terms of social justice, in terms of actual felt needs that people have. And then, of course, the longing for relationship is so important. And so as I think about the house church movement in particular, I think these longings are kind of pushing people, some people, in that direction, because they think that they'll be able to experience or at least meet these longings to a certain degree. And in some house churches, they will. In some, not so much, but that's a little bit of my suspicion that that's what's happening. Another thing I wanted to look at, and this comes out of the research of David Garrison. He's a coordinator with the Southern Baptists, the International Mission Board of the Southern Baptists. And this video shares a little bit about some church planting movements that are taking place within the Southern Baptists. But I've heard of these and some of the same kinds of characteristics in other movements, church planting movements around the world. And I wanted to show this just again to show the place that house churches have in these kinds of movements that are taking place in other parts of the world.
in astounding and marvelous ways. His love is rolling over the barriers set by governments, skeptics, religious opponents, and even geography. God's passionate desire to embrace his world will not be denied. In Asia, a strategy coordinator began his work with only 3 churches and 85 believers. Today, there are reports of as many as 340,000 believers and 3,400 churches. In North Africa, an Arab Muslim cleric complained recently that more than 10,000 Muslims in the surrounding area had left Islam to become followers of Jesus Christ. In one city in China, more than 20,000 came to faith in Jesus Christ in a 4-year period, resulting in more than 500 new churches. In Latin America, 2 Baptist unions in the face of great persecution grew from just 235 churches in 1990 to more than 1,500 Baptist churches and more than 33,000 believers. And among a people group in northern India, they grew from 29 churches to more than 4,300 churches and 300,000 believers in 11 short years. God's Spirit is moving like never before, sweeping through this world and pouring into the hearts and lives of millions of people. As reports pour in daily to the International Mission Board about the miraculous and dramatic movement of God, missiologists have struggled to identify and describe what's happening on a global scale. This special and unique movement, this dramatic outpouring of grace, this explosion of new believers and new churches is called a church planting movement.
The International Mission Board has embraced church planting movements as being something of God. In the past, as we sent out missionaries, we encouraged each one of them to be involved in evangelism that results in churches. What we found was that even our best church planting efforts weren't even keeping up with population growth rates around the world. But when we go and see these church planting movements, they're not only rapidly growing across the city or across a people group, they're actually outstripping the population growth rate of that people or that city or that country.
A church planting movement is a rapidly multiplying increase of indigenous churches planting churches within a given people group or population segment. It is rapid, with dramatic increases in church starts. It is multiplication growth, not just incremental growth. 2 churches become 4, which become 8, which become 16, and so on. This kind of growth is only possible when church members, rather than missionaries or clergy, take the lead in planting new churches. And it is indigenous. While missionaries and clergy may provide an initial thrust, the energy and momentum comes from within the people group itself.
We're seeing young couples, we're seeing young adults, we're seeing people who are 2x2 leaving their village, going to the next village, and literally with not more than a Bible in their hand, the Holy Spirit in their heart, starting new groups, leading people to faith, starting new churches that are meeting in homes there, organizing some training programs and moving on. It is exciting. It's a fun time to be a missionary.
There are church planting movements all around our world today, in Asia, Africa, Europe, and Latin America. Cambodia is a site of a church planting movement. Once home to a proud and powerful dynasty, Cambodia's recent history is a tragic story of genocide and unprecedented human suffering. A victim of the Vietnam conflict, Cambodia emerged from that war with the Maoist dictator Pol Pot, who drove the country to complete ruin. From 1975 to 1979, more than 3.3 million of Cambodia's people simply vanished, many the victims of executions, disease, and starvation. During this time, missionaries were expelled and many Christians were persecuted and murdered. By 1990, it was estimated that the Christian population had dwindled to no more than 600 believers. And yet, it was in this fullness of time that God chose to pour out His Spirit among the Khmer people of Cambodia. A young Southern Baptist strategy coordinator named Bruce Carlton emerged from language training in 1991. He and his wife Gloria began their work among the Khmer. Instead of planting a church themselves, they drew together six Cambodian believers who were mentored, instructed, and instilled with a vision to reach their nation for Christ. They planted six churches. In 1993, it grew to 10 churches. In 1994, it doubled to 20. In 1995, there were 43 churches. In 1996, 78. In 1997, 123. By 2000, 9 years after the first churches had been planted, Baptist counted more than 220 churches and 28,000 believers.
To me, it's like being in the middle of the book of Acts. Christians are going and they're preaching the gospel, they're planting house churches, they're coming up against persecution, there are signs and wonders that are happening, and the church is spreading in places where it had never spread before.
While circumstances and details of church planting movements vary from people group to people group, strategists have observed 10 characteristics which seem to be common to all. The first is prayer. The second is abundant gospel sowing. Another vital characteristic is intentional church planting. Another is a recognition of the Bible as the guiding authority for doctrine, church polity, and life itself. In a church planting movement, local believers, rather than outsiders, hold the key positions of leadership and responsibility. Further, these leaders are primarily lay leaders, not professional clergy or missions professionals. A seventh characteristic is that these churches meet as cell or house churches, often with congregations of between 10 and 30 members. Another vital characteristic is that churches are planting the churches. Missionaries and others may plant the first few churches, but soon the church members themselves take on this task, and the process of growth begins. In church planting movements, the growth is always rapid and nearly out of control. Missionaries and church leaders often struggle to keep up with the rapid growth and changes in a church planting movement. Finally, these churches exhibit characteristics of worship, evangelism and outreach, education and discipleship, ministry and fellowship. Church planting movements are also vulnerable, especially to outside influences. Missionaries are finding that they must go to great lengths not to introduce anything into a movement that cannot be replicated by the people themselves. This is especially true when it comes to things like new church buildings and financial support.
If they decide to build their own building, this is fine. This is good. Let them do it. It may serve a great purpose. The important thing is, though, that they decide when they're going to do it, and that the missionaries or outsiders not come in and say, you need a building. We're going to build a building for you.
It means that you are helping to facilitate a local person to begin that church, and to begin it in such a way that it can be multiplied dependent entirely just on local resources and not on outside resources. God is at work in exciting and wonderful ways throughout our world. Church planting movements are among the most dramatic and awesome expressions of God's great outpouring in these final days. For this reason, the overseas leadership of the International Mission Board are directing their strategy and resources to support and encourage these movements worldwide. This focus on church planting movements worldwide has necessitated a shift in some fields away from some traditional forms of missionary work to methods which more directly support this movement. Missionaries often find themselves in more transitory roles as they catalyze a movement and then leave to begin a work elsewhere. Nevertheless, there is joy at being able to ride the crest of the wave of God's great movement in these days.
We talk about being on mission with God, and for us, that's not rhetoric. That's a humble admission that it's His mission. It's His mandate to reach the whole world. We are simply joyful and grateful participants.
You know, it's hard to explain, but there's nothing like being in the middle of seeing rapid church growth and seeing God's Spirit move throughout a people.
In this new role, we have the opportunity to see God at work multiplying the number of people who are coming to know Him and are being brought up.
The kingdom of God is expanding, and we're having a chance to see it. Sometimes even be a part of it, help bring that thing into being.
As you think about those 10 characteristics of church planting movements, you know, assuming that some of that stuff would be good here in Canada in terms of our small group ministries, you know, and I recognize that not everything is transferable, but as you think about those 10 characteristics, what stands out to you that we could learn from in terms of our small groups? Any comments on that? Responses?
Reproduction.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you see that multiplication and the impact, right, that begins to happen. That is exciting.
I like that it's so exciting that they can't contain it.
They can't contain it, yeah.
That they have to, like, okay, let's make sure everything's okay, but
yeah. Yeah, there's something exciting about that multiplication, you know, and the movements that are taking place really are multiplicative, you know, they're adding by multiplication, yeah.
I'm a little bit worried about, because the rapid multiplication, just so the house church and the people are rapidly expanded so fast.
Yeah. So in a fast reproducing kind of movement, how do you kind of keep them following Jesus? It seems to me that was the same problem that they faced in the early church, right? Where people were coming to know Christ and you know, churches were being planted, and you know, you think about some of Paul's letters, they were smacking the people, you know, you shouldn't be doing that, right? Because they didn't know better, or they did and they were still doing it. You know, and so I think that's what happens when you're involved in these kind of rapidly reproducing movements, is you have to, you know, often take quick steps to try to address these issues. I know when we were in Thailand is a place where the church is growing, I think 7% per year, which is 7 times the population growth rate. They still have a very small minority of the population, but as I was doing research on the church and this movement that's taking place, that was one of my concerns, was their leadership development wasn't keeping pace. And so I think for this thing to sustain itself, you do have to make sure that you have the leaders in place. You think about the Apostle Paul. He needed to travel around and appoint elders, right? Because all of a sudden now you've got these churches, and there needs to be some kind of assurance that they're going to keep following Jesus. All right, well, let's continue with this whole theme of what can we learn. And some of the characteristics of healthy house churches, I'm just going to talk about them, and I'm not saying that these are exclusive to house churches. Many small groups experience these as well to some degree. I like the simplicity. And I already alluded to that earlier in response to Dan, that when you have a simple structure, it does often give you more time, energy, capacity to invest in the lives of people. And that was our experience. Now, you can fill your life with other things too, right? We have many opportunities in our North American society. But when you have minimal programs, minimal organizational requirements, and expenses, all of a sudden you have resources at your disposal, both time, money, emotion, whatever. Now, having said that, even though the structures were simple, we didn't find that the ministry was simple. Because as we invested deeply into each other's lives, we realized that we're all messed up. and we had to deal with the complexities of people's lives and the situations that they found themselves in. So house church may be simple, but it's not easy, I guess would be the point that I would make there. But I think we can learn something from this. And you begin to read books like Simple Church, which is actually, I've forgotten the author. Does someone know offhand, Simple Church? Okay. It's really encouraging us to, in our conventional churches, to simplify our structures so that we can actually engage more with people, right? We developed in the 80s, 90s, and into the 2000s this programmatic approach. If we add more programs, that's a good thing. And we're building all of these wonderful programs, and people are so involved and tapped out. And to expect them to invest deeply in people's lives sometimes is too much to expect. Another thing that we appreciated about house church was the relational aspect of it. I think that because house church was sort of it, you know, that was our Christian community, we were much more likely to engage with people, to build relationships, to get together with them during the week. But that's something we can learn in our small groups. That's something that we can adopt. And I think in our churches, we can learn to simplify. You know, if our people are overcommitted, maybe we need to change our structures and our expectations. You know, maybe we don't have to have 7 children's programs or 2 or whatever the case may be. And I've got young kids, so I do believe in children's programs. But, I think that we had an opportunity for authenticity. The intimacy was there. And I already mentioned the whole intergenerational experience was important to us. Tomorrow, for those of you who are coming back, David McVitie is doing a session on multi-generational small groups, which I think is just brilliant. I love that concept. It's not easy. And we did that in house church for a few years, and you've got babies and teenagers, and you're sometimes figuring out how this is all going to work. But often it did work quite well. And so the relational emphasis is certainly can be a part of that. The whole missional thing. You know, you talk about rapidly reproducing small groups, house churches. If that happens, wonderful. I would love to see more of that happening in Canada, in North America, these rapidly multiplying churches and small groups, these movements that are happening in many other parts of the world. And we do see some evidence of it here, too. But what I found that, especially when we decided to do our neighborhood house church, I mean, we were thinking mission. And we had, it's not like we hadn't been prior. We'd been praying for our neighbors, building relationships, but it kind of helped us to step it up a notch. And then when we had our little church meeting there, we could have done this better. And if you read Connecting Church 2.0 by Randy Frazee, they've developed a whole model of neighborhood small groups where, you build community in your neighborhood, and then as a Christian community, you begin reaching out to your neighbors. And interestingly enough, I read his first book about 10 years ago, the first version of it. In the second version, which just came out, he found that over the 10 years that they've been practicing that these neighborhood small groups, some of them become little house churches because they built a community. And you've got all of a sudden people coming to know Christ. They're a part of this small group and going, why would I go to the big church that you guys call your home church? This is what I want to experience, this kind of Christian community. And so anyway, that's something that they've experienced with their small groups. I think that's another thing that we can learn from the house church movement. I'm not afraid of my small group becoming church for people. If that happens, great. I don't need to get them into South Langley MB church building. Because that's not the church. The church is us. And we can meet, we can gather, we can express who we are as Christians in many different ways. So the whole missional part of it. I appreciated, too, the flexibility that we had in coming alongside new friends. I keep referring to what Dennis shared in his missional communities because it impacted me so much as I listened to him. But I loved what he was saying. It just, we come alongside people in the rhythms of life, and we do life with them. We celebrate, we grieve, we eat together. And I don't feel like we got to the point like he was describing, but we began to do some of that. Because, again, we didn't have a lot of other church commitments, we had the freedom to build those kinds of relationships. And then also in changing to address needs and opportunities within the group. If somebody comes to house church and they all of a sudden, need money, or they have a particular need that we can meet as a group, a fix-it-up kind of need, a project or whatever, we can jump to that. And again, that can happen in a small group. Hopefully does, right? And you have that kind of community. Participatory, everyone can use their gifts and abilities. There's interactive learning that encourages personal discovery and application of biblical truths, can provide a context for extraordinary prayer. It's one of the things that we saw with this one, using their gifts and abilities, is it just sort of naturally happened in the small group. People just were here, and they contributed, because this was church to them. This was their opportunity to be the people that God had created them to be in community. And that was kind of eye-opening to me, that just naturally happened. No one really needed to be encouraged, although we did some of that too in terms of leadership development and helping people take the next steps. There's a number of recommended books. Organic Church, I mentioned. This particular book, Getting Started, if you know of people who kind of want to take their small group and turn it into a house church or add elements of it, it's a great book. And one of my students a couple weeks ago found out that there's a free version of it. I forgot to put it. I don't think I put it on there yet. So I'll do that. I'll have that on our Ministry Lift website as one of the handouts for this session. Connecting Church, I mentioned, another good one, David Garrison on church planting movements. Wolfgang Simpson has written a book on house churches. It was the first, I think it was the first book I read on house churches, a fairly good and balanced perspective on it. And then kind of the go-to book, it's really a reference manual on house church, is this one called Nexus. It's filled with with chapters written by leaders in the house church movements around the world. For anyone who's really interested in diving into the church planning movement or church house churches, this is kind of the magnum opus so far out there. Well, we've already had some discussion along the way, but I just want to open it up if there's other comments or questions about house church. Sorry? Oh, yeah, and it works a little bit better if you do grab a microphone just so that our online folks, they can hear it more clearly. Thanks, Caleb, for reminding me that. Yeah.
Thanks for the lecture, Randy.
Yeah.
I was intrigued by how you had mentioned being part of your small group/house church as far as finding time to think missionally, think about how to reach those in your neighborhood. That's my heart, and it's often been challenging to find that time in life group, or your house church. How do you make time for that and keep it as part of your routine?
Right, yeah. Yeah, and I think that's a key question. As we think about our small groups, how can we make them more missional, more evangelistic, more outreach oriented? And I look back on my small group leadership experiences, and I don't think I've been very successful at it. You know, apart from the house church concept where we focused on doing it, like that was why we, you know, why I left being a pastor was to be this kind of person and to be involved with people. I think it often involves just taking those baby steps, right? Beginning conversations about who are the people in our lives that we want to reach? Can we pray for them at least? Can we ask each other, you know, how's it going with John? You know, we prayed for him last week. And that's something we did do in house church, was each week we would try to have that time where we would pray for our unsaved friends. And that kept it more in the forefront. And then we would share stories, too. And it was terribly encouraging when you pray one week, and then several weeks later you hear about how that person has taken some sort of faith step, right? And it begins to build a culture, an understanding that we're here not just for ourselves. I mentioned it in the last session that one of the research studies, this one, Small Groups, Big Impact, that I'll be diving into actually in detail tomorrow. For those of you that won't be here, you can also access that as a recording when it's up. I mean, they say that, you know, we have this mistaken notion that if we somehow protect the intimacy by not including others, that we're actually doing ourselves a disservice. The research indicated in that study that as people open themselves up and as new people come, that actually strengthens a sense of community, what Al Hirsch calls communitas, a deep sense of community. And I think that's so true. So, I mean, I've got a lot of questions and ideas, and I'm struggling with the implementation part of it. One of the things that we're just doing in our neighborhood right now is we've started meeting with another Christian couple. We're praying for our neighbors. We're hoping that will develop into something with our neighbors. Certainly in terms of building relationships and serving them, but perhaps it could develop into some sort of group. And that's our hope and prayer. We did invite our neighbors to an Alpha course, and nobody showed up. So, you know, we're kind of just praying at this point, and we're not sure what the next step will be. Other questions, comments about this stuff? Online, anything coming in? I think we're done. Thank you so much. And for those of you who... this was your one day available for coming, and you won't be here tomorrow. Thank you for coming, being a part of this day. For those of you who are coming back, look forward to seeing you tomorrow.